Hello, this is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Joanne Lowney, with today's Wall Street Journal. Here are today's business headlines. The $10 billion proposal to speed up U.S.-Mexico trade. Investigators study helicopter blades in deadly Hudson River crash. The biggest companies across America are cutting their workforces. Nippon to close U.S. steel deal after national security pact with Trump. U.K.'s Reynolds agrees to $254 million private equity takeover by MPE Bideo. Bojangles is exploring a sale while the fried chicken market is hot. Tariffs test Sam's Club strategy of keeping prices as low as possible. The aisle-prowling Albertsons CEO taking on Kroger. Rent the Runway sees rebound in subscribers and aims to add more styles to keep them. Victoria's Secret is under mounting pressure from latest activist investor. ICE raids have sent Latino shoppers into hiding, and big brands are hurting. Our first article today is the $10 billion proposal to speed up U.S.-Mexico trade. Green Corridors, an Austin startup, has gotten U.S. clearance to build a guideway on which autonomous hybrid shuttles would ferry freight between Mexico and Texas, by Liz Young. President Trump is breathing life into a $10 billion project to alleviate congestion at the country's busiest border crossing for trade between the U.S. and Mexico. Trump this month issued a presidential permit to Austin, Texas-based Green Corridors to build a 165-mile elevated guideway for self-driving shuttles to haul freight between Laredo, Texas and Monterrey, Mexico. Chief Executive Mitch Carlson said Green Corridors plans to build four cross-border terminals of about 100 acres each, two in Laredo and two in Monterrey, which would be connected via the extended corridor. Truck drivers hauling freight would come into the terminals and drop their 53-foot dry van trailers, which would then be loaded onto autonomous diesel-electric hybrid shuttles that travel along the designated path, much like a monorail. When the shuttle arrives at the other end of the guideway, truckers would pick up a trailer and carry the goods further into the U.S. or Mexico. Carlson said he sees the project complementing existing truck and railroad operations. Green Corridors is focused on trips under 200 miles, less than the long-haul distances railroads specialize in. On June 9th, Trump issued a permit granting privately held Green Corridors permission to construct, maintain, and operate the border crossing. The permit expires in 5 years if construction hasn't started by then. The company said it's working to secure permits from the Mexican government. Green Corridors is also negotiating with several landowners and developers to line up the real estate needed to build the terminals and has several other permitting stages to go through before construction can begin. He said he expects to complete construction and enter the testing phase in 2031. More companies have set up manufacturing hubs in Mexico over the past several years, prompting logistics companies to increase investment in the region and putting added pressure on existing trade routes. The Port of Laredo handled more than 3 million truck crossings into the U.S. last year, up 28% from 2019, according to the Bureau of Transportation Statistics. The port is a major gateway for imports of auto parts, vehicles, appliances, and electronics. Green Corridors says its system is meant to complement and relieve regional congestion, including at the two existing vehicle bridges in the area that handle commercial traffic. The World Trade Bridge and the Laredo-Columbia Solidarity International Bridge. Projects are underway to expand the two bridges and build an additional vehicle crossing called the Laredo 4 to four-fifths International Bridge. A White House official said the proposed bridge could help reduce wait times for cross-border travel, improve supply chain resilience, and create additional capacity to support growing trade with Mexico. The average wait time at the two existing bridges is about 45 minutes on a weekday afternoon, according to U.S. Customs and Border Protection. Earlier this year, the Trump administration temporarily placed steep tariffs on Mexican imports before pausing some of the duties. Even so, Jason Miller, a logistics professor at Michigan State University, said he anticipates trade between the U.S. and Mexico will continue to grow in the coming years, especially if tariffs on goods from China remain higher than on those from Mexico. That's going to result in certainly some shifting of production from China to Mexico, Miller said. The Green Corridors project is estimated to cost upwards of $10 billion, Carlson said. The company will charge companies a fee to use the guideway, similar to a toll road. The project is backed by investors, including the Swine Bank Family Office in Houston, Drucker Capital in New York, and Chang Robotics Fund in Jacksonville, Florida. Write to Liz Young at liz.young@wsj.com. The self-driving truck startup that siphoned trade secrets to Chinese companies. TuSimple shared with Beijing best-in-class autonomous driving system and became an example of Washington's shortcomings in keeping critical technology in the U.S. by Heather Somerville. A week after one of America's largest self-driving truck companies promised the U.S. government it would stop sharing sensitive technology with Chinese partners, TuSimple transferred a trove of data to Beijing-owned firm. They want a lot of details, Zhaoling Hang, a U.S.-based TuSimple Holdings employee, said to a colleague. A leading Chinese commercial truck manufacturer, Foton, sought the data from TuSimple's many test drives around Texas. It's pretty time-consuming, Han wrote in a February 2022 chat exchange seen by the Wall Street Journal. TuSimple was a leader in the global race to develop self-driving trucks that could solve chronic driver shortages, make freight hauling cheaper, and bolster military operations. Founded by two Chinese entrepreneurs with money from a Chinese business mogul, the San Diego-based company set a record when its truck traveled 80 miles in Arizona without a human driver. It shared the technical feat and others achieved on American highways with its partners in China, according to hundreds of pages of previously unreported company correspondence viewed by the journal. Within a year and a half, TuSimple's voluntary shut down its U.S. operations, auctioned off its trucks, and delisted from the NASDAQ. Its leaders moved hundreds of millions of dollars raised from U.S. investors from the company's accounts to China, according to legal documents, and started new business ventures. The story of TuSimple's technology transfer and the political imbroglio that followed laid bare the weaknesses in U.S. laws aimed at facilitating foreign investment while protecting American know-how. It is now informing a transformation of how the U.S. policies companies with Chinese ties. In February, President Trump told his administration to stop using a particular type of agreement intended to monitor the behavior of risky companies. That is in part because his advisors had been so frustrated by the scope of intellectual property TuSimple was able to export to China, people familiar with the matter said. Some officials now believe the U.S. has erred on entrusting Chinese entities to abide by such agreements and should be more willing to block China-backed business deals outright. The TuSimple case also helped shape new Commerce Department rules issued this year prohibiting sales of internet-connected cars and their components that have ties to China, according to a person familiar with the matter. Similar rules for commercial vehicles, including heavy trucks, are forthcoming. Documents viewed by the journal show how Two Simples shared with Chinese partners an array of data that mounted to the design of an American-made autonomous driving system. They show the sharing continued between then Two Simples signed a national security agreement with the U.S. government in February 2022 and its deadline to comply 6 months later. The agreement ordered Two Simples to separate its business and technology from China-based employees and partners with firewalls and governance controls, and to prevent the sharing of intellectual property. It was enforced by the Committee on Foreign Investment in the U.S., or CFIUS, an interagency national security panel. A CFIUS investigation ultimately determined that Two Simples tech sharing hadn't violated its national security agreement, but it fined the company for other infractions, according to a person with knowledge of the events. Two Simples paid a $6 million settlement without admitting fault. Two Simples' co-founder, Xiaodai Du Hao, who left the company in 2023, said no information prohibited by the company's national security agreement was ever shared with anyone. Hao and Mo Chen co-founded Two Simples a decade ago with money from Charles Chow, who runs a Chinese media empire called Sina. They built much of the company in the U.S., which offered an easier regulatory environment, the world's largest freight trucking market, and abundant access to capital. Two Simples in 2021 raised a $1.4 billion in the first ever U.S. public listing by a self-driving trucking company, and signed business deals with the United Parcel Service, Volkswagen, and Navistar International. As Two Simples gained momentum in the U.S., Chen founded another startup in China called Hydron that said it had plans to build a hydrogen-powered trucks for Two Simples. Hydron, also funded by tens of millions from Sina, according to people familiar with the matter, had a few operations of its own and shared employees and an office with Two Simples in Beijing. Hydron, in late 2021, struck an agreement to develop autonomous driving trucks with Foton in a deal that was negotiated by Two Simples, according to a document seen by the journal. Foton is a subsidiary of China state-owned VAIC Group, which has an agreement with the Chinese military university to work on driverless technology. BAIC and Foton didn't respond to requests for comment. One email, Slack message, and video conference at a time, Two Simples sent Chinese partners technical instructions for server dimensions, brake designs, sensors, steering, power supply, and chips, according to documents seen by the journal. Some of the documents, which also contain schematics and compute requirements, were translated from Chinese. In the Beijing office shared by Two Simples and Hydron, employees routinely downloaded the autonomy source code developed by engineers in the U.S. through joint access to a repository, former employees said. Hao said Two Simples never shared protected information with Hydron and isn't aware of any plan to collaborate with Foton. Documents seen by the journal show Two Simples staff communicating frequently with Foton. At times, Two Simples shared technology that had been developed with American partners, including Navistar. Han, the Two Simples employee, said the colleagues to provide Foton truck steering control system designs that were created based on the results of previous discussions with Navistar, according to a March 2022 email. A spokesman from Navistar, now called International Motors, declined to comment. Han and Chen didn't respond to requests for comment. CFIUS representatives visited Two Simples' headquarters in April 2022 and concluded that Too Simple hadn't violated its agreement, according to people familiar with the matter. Later that year, CFIUS members referred company leadership to the Justice Department for possible trade secrets theft and economic espionage charges. The U.S. government, across administrations, has identified maintaining America's superiority over China in technology, including autonomous driving, as a pressing national security priority. But autonomous driving systems aren't explicitly covered by export controls, and the phalanx of foreign investment reviews and criminal investigations have provided limited protection. The Federal Bureau of Investigations and Securities and Exchange Commission opened investigations into TrueSimple's relationship with Hydron in 2022. The following year, the Commerce Department intercepted an attempt by TrueSimple to ship NVIDIA artificial intelligence chips out of the country and launched an investigation. In a recent public filing, TrueSimple said it had reached an agreement on a settlement with the SEC that awaited commission approval. The status of the other investigations couldn't be learned. A law firm hired by TrueSimple's board to investigate TrueSimple's various dealings with Hydron reported finding evidence of deep and long-standing ties with the Chinese company, according to a document seen by the journal. How is making another run at self-driving trucks with a new company in Texas called Bot Auto? The startup is staffed with former TrueSimple employees, including Han, and funded partly with Chinese capital. Hao, a U.S. citizen, said no foreign entity has a controlling or majority stake in his company. Chen and TrueSimple's chief executive, Chen Liu, dismissed the U.S. government probes during a September press conference in China. The pair is now using money from TrueSimple to fund a new venture in China, creating AI for automation, with help from Chao's company, Sina. These investigations are relatively minor issues, Liu said. Write to Heather Somerville at heather.somerville@wsj.com. Investigators study helicopter blades in deadly Hudson River crash. FAA sought information from aircraft owners and operators about severe vibrations. Blade manufacturer alerted pilots of how to deal with such events by Robert Barba and Andrew Kangel. Accident investigators are examining whether problems with the helicopter's rotor blades contributed to the aircraft crashing near New York City earlier this year, according to people familiar with the matter. The April 10th crash in the Hudson River killed six, including a Spanish couple who worked for manufacturing conglomerate Siemens, the couple's three children, and the helicopter pilot. The family was taking a sightseeing tour when the Bell 2206L-4 helicopter entered a rapid descent as it approached the Holland Tunnel ventilation towers, investigators said. The helicopter was outfitted with blades manufactured by Tempe, Arizona-based Van Horn Aviation, according to Mike Roth, owner of the tour company New York Helicopter. The blades, made with materials including fiberglass and carbon fiber, are common replacements when a manufacturer's metal blades wear out. In early May, the Federal Aviation Administration issued an airworthiness concern sheet seeking information about severe vibrations from operators of Bell 206L helicopters, a model used by military, law enforcement, and air ambulance companies in the U.S. The FAA request for information, which doesn't mention the fatal April crash, referenced an incident where vibrations resulted in substantial damage to the helicopter's tail boom. Pete Emerson, the pilot in that incident last September, said in an interview that the helicopter he was flying alone began to shake violently. Unsure what was happening, he maneuvered to land the aircraft, which he said extended the shaking. It scared me to death. I thought I was going to die. The helicopter was vibrating so hard, Emerson said. Emerson said that based on conversations with Van Horn officials after the incident and what he has learned from online forums, violent shaking can occur when a chopper outfitted with composite blades is carrying a light load, such as when a pilot is flying alone and fuel is running low. He said he wishes that information would have been clearly communicated when he purchased the blades. In March, the month before the Hudson River crash, Van Horn issued an alert to pilots about how to deal with the vibrations on the Bell model's outfit with its blades, as well as several maintenance steps. The National Transportation Safety Board, which is investigating the April crash, hasn't reached any conclusions about what factors contributed to the accident. A final accident report is likely months away, and areas of focus in the probe could shift as new information comes to light. Van Horn said it respects the process of an NTSB investigation and that it wouldn't comment on accident-related matters until the investigation has been completed. Bell, a unit of Textron, declined to comment about the investigation. A Bell spokeswoman said the company encouraged operators to report any vibrational events to the FAA in response to the agency's request. The FAA said it hasn't determined what type of corrective action, if any, may be necessary. The helicopter operated by Ross Company was leased from Louisiana-based Meridian Helicopters. The composite blades had about 1,000 hours of use and were installed roughly a year before the crash, Roth said. Meridian didn't respond to a request for comment. Roth said he was looking forward to the results of the FAA and the NTSB investigations. For now, Roth's tour company remains grounded. The FAA halted its operations after the crash and pledged to review the company's license and safety record. Roth said his business operated for roughly 26 years with no issues. An FAA audit after the crash found no significant operational problems nor issues with the airworthiness of the tour company's helicopters, according to people briefed on its findings. The FAA declined to comment on the audit. Write to Robert Barba at robert.barba@wsj.com and Andrew Tengle at andrew.tengle@wsj.com. The biggest companies across America are cutting their workforces. It isn't just Amazon. There's growing belief that having too many employees will slow a company down and that anyone still on the payroll could be working harder. By Chip Cutter and Lauren Weber. Corporate America is convinced fewer employees means faster growth. U.S. public companies have reduced their white-collar workforces by a collective 3.5% over the past 3 years, according to employment data provider Live Data Technologies. Over the past decade, one in five companies in the S&P 500 have shrunk. The cuts go beyond typical cost trimming and speak to a broader shift in philosophy. Adding talent, once a sign of surging sales and confidence in the future, now means leaders must be doing something wrong. New technologies like generative artificial intelligence are allowing companies to do more with less. But there's more to this movement. From Amazon in Seattle to Bank of America in Charlotte, North Carolina, and at companies big and small everywhere in between, there's a growing belief that having too many employees is itself an impediment. The message from many bosses is anyone still on the payroll could be working harder. In a note to employees on Tuesday, Amazon chief executive Andy Jassy wrote that the once-in-a-lifetime rise of AI will eliminate the need for certain jobs in the next few years. And earlier this year, he told his staff that not every new project requires 50 people to do it. The best leaders, he added in his annual letter to shareholders, get the most done with the least number of resources required to do the job. Procter & Gamble said this month that it would cut 7,000 jobs, or 15% of its non-manufacturing workforce, to create broader roles and smaller teams. Estee Lauder and dating app operator Match Group recently said they had each jettisoned around 20% of their managers. Flatter is faster. Hewlett-Packard Enterprises finance chief Marie Mayers told investors this month as she discussed recent staff cuts. With fewer than 59,000 employees, HPE is at its smallest size since it became an independent company a decade ago, she pointed out. All of the shrinking turns it on its head the usual cycle of hiring and firing. Companies often get let go of workers in recessions, then staff up when the economy picks up. Yet the workforce cuts in recent years coincide with a surge in sales and profits, heralding a more fundamental shift in the way leaders evaluate their workforces. U.S. corporate profits rose to a record high in the end of last year, according to the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis. Everyone with 500 employees and up that I talk to off the record, including public companies, says, I don't need 30% to 40% of my team. Tech investor and former Adobe executive Jason Lemkin said in a venture capital podcast last month. In all, about one in five S&P 500 companies have fewer employees today in both office and field than a decade ago. And it isn't all due to selling or spinning off some operations, according to the Wall Street Journal analysis of public filings. That includes bellwether names such as Walmart, General Motors, and Bank of America, whose sales have all climbed over that time. As some in corporate America get leaner, the U.S. workforce as a whole still grew over the past decade, as the healthcare sector expanded and the ranks of government workers increased. The downsizing has caused employees to rapidly lose the leverage they enjoyed during the pandemic, when jobs were plentiful and companies were bidding up for white-collar talent. Even with AI advances in the horizon, many corporate leaders and labor economists have projected long-term shortages in both salaried and hourly jobs. Now workers are contending with bigger workloads, more responsibilities, and a nagging fear about their job security and future prospects. Employees are too nervous to make moves, Misha Fisher, an economist and education platform Udemy, wrote in an analysis of the latest U.S. jobs report. This freeze is blocking normal opportunity flow. Early career workers can't break in, experienced workers can't move up, and burned out employees stay put. Managers have been an especially ripe target for cutting. Though Live Data Technologies data show, public companies have pared back their non-managerial ranks recently too. The number of managers dropped 6.1% between May 2022 and May 2025. Executive levels roles fell 4.6%. While Brian Mollingham became CEO of Bank of America in 2010, the company employed 285,000 people. The bank closed branches, digitized more processes, and didn't replace people when they quit. In recent years, it cut its management layers to about 7 from 13. Today, it has about 213,000 employees, and revenues are up 18% from a decade ago. We have a higher producing company with fewer people and lower costs, Moynihan told investors in April. Companies flattening has left managers leading larger teams. In 2020, managers had an average of 4.2 direct reports, according to Lattice, a human resources software provider. By 2023, that number was 5.1. They have delayered to the point of making the companies anorexic, said Joseph Fuller, a management professor at Harvard Business School. That can backfire and eventually hurt employees' productivity, he added. Their ability to do deep work and really focus goes down consistently because they're endlessly distracted, and now they're doing the work that three people did 10 years ago. Yet revenue per employee is back in favor as a metric investors and executives track carefully. Among bosses watching it closely is Grindr CEO George Arison. When he took the helm of the dating app in 2022, it made about $1 million in revenue per employee. Within 2 years, that figure more than doubled. Grindr kept the pace of hiring below even its internal projections, rolled out new productivity tools, and leaned on existing staff to do more. I was pretty clear that people are not working as much as they need to, Arison said. Others are now urging their teams to do more with the same resources. We're going to launch 10 products, Stephanie Bansal, CEO of COVID vaccine maker Moderna, said in an investor conference in late May. The challenge I have for our team is, how do we launch those 10 products without adding headcount? Generative AI is already allowing executives to imagine future with even fewer workers. CEOs at both e-commerce platform Shopify and foreign language learning app Duolingo recently told their teams that future hiring would be predicated on first showing the work couldn't be automated. Duolingo's CEO softened the messaging after social media uproar over his memo, clarifying that his company was still hiring at the same speed as before. When Lattice wanted to add a payroll function to its line of HR software products, executives calculated they would need 40 or 50 new staff, since customers' pay issues often require immediate attention. Ultimately, Lattice added fewer than 10 people, CEO Sarah Franklin said, because current AI models are so much more sophisticated than chatbots from just a year or two ago. They can take bespoke requests, bespoke querying, and match them to give you an answer, she said. That's what we as humans do. Many employees are moving towards using more agentic AI, autonomous bots that can make decisions and complete tasks on behalf of humans, such as paying an invoice or rerouting inventory if a natural disaster interferes with a trucking route. Walmart is deploying such AI agents to shorten the timeline for producing in-house apparel up to 18 weeks. The retailer already employs 100,000 fewer people than a decade ago, its filings show. It sold operations in Brazil, the UK, and other countries during that time, but that's only part of the story. Technical innovations have also helped its revenues rise despite the lower headcount, and it has invested heavily in its e-commerce business, which is growing quickly and relies partly on freelance drivers who don't show up in the retailer's headcount data. In 2024, Walmart recorded $681 billion in sales, an increase of 40% compared with 2014. Many of today's jobs didn't exist just a few years ago, and we expect the pace of change to continue, Donna Morris, Walmart's chief people officer, said in a statement. In his note to Amazon employees Tuesday, Jassy said that generative AI and agents are growing increasingly capable. He said the company has already rolled out or is building more than 1,000 agents and predicted that AI agents will speed up the pace of innovation by taking care of rote work. Agents will allow us to start almost everything from a more advanced starting point, he said. The leaner, meaner approach is trickling down to even the smallest startups. Jolie, which sells high-end filtered shower heads, is on track to make about $50 million in annual revenue this year and has 5 employees. CEO Ryan Barbazon, who previously sold a sneaker brand to Steve Madden, said he never considered headcount as a sign of success. Jolie operates with such a lean team, which includes Barbizon's chief founder, Arjan Singh, along with employees focused on sales, marketing, and social media, by relying on digital tools and part-time contractors for some finance, operations, and logistic functions. Hiring is not necessarily like it used to be, Barbazon said. 10 years ago, it would be really difficult to build a $50 million business with five or less people. Today, I think it's going to be really, really common. Barbazon hopes to double the company's revenue to $100 million in the next few years. He estimates the company could do that by bringing on two more people. Write to Chip Cutter at chip.cutter@wsj.com and Lauren Weber at lauren.weber@wsj.com. This is your volunteer broadcaster, Joanne Lowney. If you miss any part of this program, you can get it on demand on our website, sunsounds.org, then click on our broadcast info and audio. You can take SunSounds with you. Get our stream and on demand on our new SunSounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. And you can hear SunSounds on your Echo Dot or smart home device. Now back to the next article. More of us are putting in extra hours after the workday. Employees' days are bleeding into the evening, new data show, thanks to a growing load of meetings, emails, and yes, actual work, by Ray A. Smith. If it feels like there aren't enough hours to get everything done during the workday, you're part of a growing club. More of us are working a second shift in the evening. Workers slid into the habit of working at all hours during the pandemic, when many worked from home. Though fewer people are fully remote now, many are still toiling into the night, and say an expanding load of meetings, emails, and actual work are a big reason. The number of meetings people logged after 8 p.m. over the 12 months through February, in fact, were up 16% from the year before, according to new data from Microsoft on the activity of millions of workers who use the company's business applications. By 10 p.m., nearly a third of them were back in their inboxes after pausing for dinner or home duties. Ravi Desai, who manages a global customer success team for a software company, says his days have become stacked with meetings, many of with team members and clients on the East Coast. That often leaves evenings for catching up on work, emails, and Slack messages. His schedule sends some of them for the next morning, so his reports don't feel pressure to respond at night. In his industry, though, that's tough, says Desai, who works remotely from California. There is a tendency to be generally connected at all the time, he said. There's nothing new in modern American work. That is nothing new in modern American work culture, but many workers say the intensity is rising as companies slow hiring, trim costs, and add more tasks to roles. Adoption of artificial intelligence tools at work isn't far enough along to lighten the load for most. Nearly two-thirds of U.S. workers said they don't use AI much or at all on the job in a Pew Research Center survey this year. Mentions of burnout by employees on job review site Glassdoor, meanwhile, jumped 32% in the first quarter from a year earlier, hitting their highest levels in nearly a decade. A very common theme is workers who feel like they've had several years of mounting responsibilities, says Daniel Zhao, lead economist at Glassdoor. After his department head left and wasn't replaced, Dan Quintero says he went from having no direct reports to managing several at his social media marketing job in New York. Dealing with emails and Slack messages spilled into his off hours, and he would sometimes work later to assist coworkers also juggling heavy workloads. There were definitely situations where I, just as a single human being, couldn't do all the things, says Quintero, who recently left the job. A cooling white-collar job market has made it harder for others to push back on more work. In a Gallup survey of more than 10,000 workers last summer, 63% said they had been asked to take on additional responsibilities, up from 47% in early 2023. The Microsoft data is part of the software maker's annual study of workplace productivity trends, which provides one of the largest measures of how people spend their workdays. It puts numbers to the crush of emails, messages, and meetings. Many people say consumes their time on the job. The average worker, it found, gets 117 emails and 153 chats a day. Another reason more digital communication spills into off hours is a rise in cross-time zone collaboration. About 30% of meetings span multiple time zones, up 8 percentage points since 2021. Jason Whiteup, a senior vice president at a company specializing in AI-powered advertising, says some hacks help him keep his work from sprawling into all hours. He blocks off time on a shared calendar for more focused work and uses AI tools to help write and brainstorm faster. Whiteup, who works remotely in a Seattle area, tries to leave meeting evenings for catching up on emails and reading. Still, other work sometimes creeps up, and he plans ahead to work after hours. "It just needs to be the exception and not the rule for me," he said. Write to Ray A. Smith at ray.smith@wsj.com. Is the immigration crackdown already showing up in the labor market? There are hints that the number of migrants in the U.S. labor force is declining. It will take time, though, for the full effects to show up. By Justin Lehart and Mariah Timms. The immigration crackdown may already be starting to show up on the job market. Employment growth in industries that rely heavily on unauthorized workers has slowed. There's been a large decline in the foreign-born labor force since March. Recent immigrants appear more reluctant to take part in the Labor Department's monthly survey of households. Still, there is no definitive measure in the unauthorized workforce, and the data that does exist can be volatile and difficult to parse. The Labor Department relies on two surveys to produce its monthly jobs report, one of employers and the other of households, and each has blind spots. The employer survey is where the main monthly jobs number comes from. It queries firms on how many workers they have in their payrolls. It doesn't ask questions about workers' legal status, but some companies, such as those with people working off the books, probably don't respond accurately. The employer survey doesn't include farm workers and workers in private households, two employment categories with a large number of unauthorized workers. That survey does include some industries with large shares of unauthorized workers, such as landscaping services and slaughterhouses. And as a group, these have been adding jobs at a slower rate than other private sector employers since last summer. In that time, the number of people coming into the U.S. began to fall, according to an analysis by economist Jed Kolko, who was Undersecretary for Economic Affairs at the Commerce Department during the Biden administration. But that slowdown has actually been less pronounced in recent months, according to Kolko. "We probably haven't seen the full effect from immigration policies this year yet," he said. The Labor Department's separate survey of households is where the unemployment rate, among other labor measures, comes from. It doesn't ask questions about immigration status, though it does ask if people were born in the U.S. or not. It also makes a pledge of confidentiality, but many unauthorized immigrants are still probably reluctant to participate in the survey, and lately that reluctance may have grown. Indeed, the response rate of recent immigrants has fallen this year. That, Goldman Sachs said, is a note to clients last week, raises concerns that the survey may have missed many unauthorized immigrants who are scared to go to work amid the intense immigration crackdown. Data released alongside Friday's jobs report showed that the number of foreign-born people either working or looking for work fell by about 1 million from March to May. That was the biggest two-month decline in the foreign-born labor force since the early days of the pandemic. Some economists pointed out that the decline is an indication that more unauthorized workers are exiting the labor force. The data is extremely volatile, though, and not adjusted for seasonal swings, which are severe in sectors such as farming. The ratios of both foreign and native-born employed people to population have behaved similarly in the past year. Immigration has long been an important source of labor in the U.S., particularly in recent years as the number of unauthorized immigrants flowing across the border surged. But the number of people coming into the country began falling in the later part of last year after the Biden administration tightened up the border. And it has fallen precipitously since President Trump came back into office. While raids on workplaces have made some immigrants fearful of showing up for work. Workforce authorization backlogs continue to grow, and reports of arrests at regular immigration appointments rise, scaring some potential applicants away from the process. Nicole Hallett, who runs the Immigrants' Rights Clinic at the University of Chicago, which offers free legal assistance, said many of her clients have quietly exited the workforce as new Trump administration policies put pressure on their ability to work legally in the U.S. Work permits also often create a path for immigrants to other identification and access other social programs. That said, many of the people who crossed the southern border last year are likely still entering the labor force pipeline. Many unauthorized immigrants, such as these, those who apply for asylum, are eligible for work permits, but often are required to wait before applying and then wait for approval. As of April, the latest data available, the number of people applying for these permits was high, points out Wendy Eldberg, an economist at the Brookings Institution. Hallett said she believes that many people are likely still applying for work permits even now. Workers have to feed their families, after all. Work authorization is so valuable that I think people are still applying, Hallett said. But I would say that the level of fear that people are feeling, just because they know that any time they file something, they get put on the radar, is a lot higher. New policies that strip work permit eligibility will likely have a harsher effect on workers with better jobs, not those who have found a way to survive by being paid under the table, Hallett said. An employer who pays attention to immigration law is more likely to also care about other labor laws, she's found. Conchita Cruz, co-executive director of the Asylum Seeker Advocacy Project, which represents more than 700,000 migrants in all 50 states, said the group's members aren't the only ones who feel the moment's uncertainty. Employers want the answers just as bad as the workers do in this case. Cruz, an attorney, said, "It's a rare instance where business owners and the business community are on the same page as unions and the labor movement and immigrants." The group's members span a wide range of industries and, for example, include both doctors and cleaners at the hospital, she said. Immigrant workers are playing a critical role in many different industries, Cruz said. And employers don't want to lose them. At the end of the day, it's very costly to have to retain someone, to have to find new employees, to have to replace people who otherwise are doing a great job, and you would want to keep on a job. It will still take time for the effects of the new immigration policies to show up. UBS economists further note that the employment rate for workers ages 16 to 19 rose to 13.4% in May from 13% a month earlier. Because teens typically work in sectors with higher shares of immigration workers, the economists expect teen unemployment would fall, not rise, in response to immigrants leaving the labor force. It might not take long for the immigration crackdown to show up more clearly. The Labor Department's employer and household surveys are based on mid-month readings. That means that the May jobs report that was released last week didn't include the dialing up of immigration enforcement that came in late May after top White House aide Stephen Miller told Immigration and Customs Enforcement to just go out there and arrest illegal aliens. The June jobs figures, due July 3rd, will be based on the pay period and week that includes the 12th of this month. That is Thursday. Write to Justin Lehart at justin.lehart@wsj.com. And now for some opinion articles. The Economics of Slavery Probing the incentives and institutions that kept slavery alive can help us value what freedom means. By Roland Fryer. Juneteenth marks emancipation, yet debate still rages over how to teach slavery, why it arose and persisted, and what place it holds in America's self-image. Two projects set the polls. The New York Times 1619 project recasts the nation's origin story, focusing on slavery and discrimination rather than the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. The Woodson Center's 1776 Unites argues that the Revolution's democratic ideals, imperfectly realized at the founding, launched a long arc of progress, visible from the Civil War through the Civil Rights era and beyond. Historians, sociologists, and journalists have shaped much of today's debate about slavery, but economists deserve a seat at the table too. Our comparative advantage is cutting through complexity to expose the incentives that drive behavior. An economic approach, sometimes uncomfortably clinical, focuses on profitability, capital formation and allocation, and long-run development. These seemingly mercenary measures can illuminate the issue's profound moral stakes. Learning what slavery entailed is enough to horrify us. Understanding why it endured demands economics. Moral repulsion at reducing people to property can and must coexist with the need to explain how such barbarism flourished in a nation that proclaimed all men are created equal. Only by probing the incentives and institutions that kept slavery alive can we fully appreciate what freedom means. Economic historians have long mined slavery's records. Robert Fogel's and Stanley Engerman's landmark study, Time on the Cross, 1974, and its sequel, Without Consent or Contract, 1989, digitized plantation accounts, commodity prices and slave sale records to test economic hypotheses. By quantifying output, labor productivity, and market prices, they showed how rigorous measurement can overturn received wisdom and still deepen our moral reckoning. This work, in part, earned Fogel the Nobel in Economic Sciences in 1993. Fogel and Engerman's analysis stripped away any illusion that slavery was haphazard. Skilled labor fetched a premium. Blacksmiths and carpenters sold for roughly 50% more than ordinary field hands, while drinkers, habitual runaways, and other defective workers were discounted by a similar margin. Slaveholders priced in age, too. Boys and girls 10 to 14 were valued at about 40% of the prime male's productivity, and the ledgers captured it. Even productivity for pregnant women was quantified. In the week before and after delivery, enslaved women picked barely a third of their peak cotton load, 31.6 pounds. Yet by 8 weeks postpartum, they were back to 92% efficiency. Long before anyone coined the term business analytics, plantation owners were running a data-driven labor system. Armed with their newly digitized records, Fogel and Engerman showed that slavery was economically shrewd for Southern landowners. The gang labor system, in which slaves were divided into groups under slave drivers who disciplined out-of-line workers, was its brutal engine. That system drove enslaved workers to toil about 76% harder each hour than free laborers or slaves on non-gang farms, slashing unit labor costs and lifting output. In head-to-head comparisons, slave plantations consistently outperformed operations that relied on free labor alone. Slavery endured not only because society condoned it, but also because for slaveholders it paid. Fogel and Engerman overturned the then fashionable view that bondage was an economically backward form of racist exploitation, manned by an idle workforce that dragged the South down. Their data revealed a colder truth. For those who owned people, slavery was the most profitable and therefore most retained labor system on offer. Recognizing the profit calculus behind slavery doesn't dilute its moral horror, it sharpens it. It exposes how market incentive can outreach inhumanity and how the lure of profit can eclipse compassion. American slavery ended as it began by brute force, yet debate over its modern economic and social aftershocks continue. For two decades, I've asked my Harvard undergraduates whether slavery harms them today. They invariably answer yes. Pressed for specifics, they cite lack of wealth creation, neighborhood segregation, or lingering notions of black inferiority once used to justify bondage. But when I request empirical proof, the room goes silent. I then point to them to the brilliant work of economist Nathan Nunn, whose data-rich studies quantify slavery's enduring drag on economic growth, inequality, and social capital. Parsing evidence from Africa to the U.S. countries, Mr. Nunn finds a clear pattern. The heavier a region's slave reliance in the 1800s, the worse its economic performance today. Within the U.S., for instance, low slave states such as Maryland and Missouri outlearn high slave states like South Carolina and Louisiana, even 1.5 centuries later. Differences that persist after controlling for education, urbanization, and other confounding variables. Mr. Nunn's most striking evidence concerns trust and his approach to causality as an impressive as a result. He exploits a quirk of geography. In the 19th century, regions cut off by rugged terrain or far from navigable rivers were too costly for slave traders on horseback to reach, so they supplied far fewer captives. By using this natural variation on accessibility, Mr. Nunn isolates the slave trade's causal effect. Communities with the heaviest historical slave exports now report the lowest levels of trust towards neighbors, other ethnic groups, and their own governments. That distrust is no historical footnote. It remains a break on social capital formation and growth. The institutions themselves may function well, Mr. Nunn argues, but the culture shaped by the slave trade and stories handed down through generations still affects how people perceive others and institutions today. Juneteenth rightly celebrates the day slavery's shackles were broken. Yet the work of reckoning remains. We must teach this history candidly, dust for its fingerprints in today's inequalities, and repair the economic, social, and institutional distortions left behind. Slavery is gone, but the marks it etched on American life endure. Facing them squarely is the only way to erase them. Mr. Fryer, a journal contributor, is a professor of economics at Harvard, a founder of Equal Opportunity Ventures, and a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. That brings us to the end of today's edition of the Wall Street Journal. I'm Joanne Lowney, your volunteer broadcaster on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Stay tuned for more interesting programs on Sun Sounds.